I'm speaking with Andres. Andres is an activist and an organizer who has been living in Oaxaca for approximately 4 years. I'm talking to Andres from an undisclosed location in Mexico. Welcome, Andres.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
My first question is, for me as a programmer, it's been difficult to find somebody to speak to directly from Oaxaca because clearly, because of the repression, most active organizers are underground. And I'm wondering if you could describe for our listeners the situation for the people who are affiliated with APO, the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, and other groupings. What is the situation right now? How open can people be about their political affiliations? How underground do people have to be at this point in time?
Most people, what a lot of the organizers have been slowly returning to the city. About 20 days ago, some of the arrest warrants were suspended. So after a great deal of arrests that took place at the end of November, and then a series of arrest warrants that were to be executed, most people had to flee if they hadn't already been arrested or imprisoned. And so things are back to or are tending towards an apparent normality. The Mexican state right now has an interest in saying that everything and demonstrating that everything is back to normal and that Oaxaca is not in fact under a de facto state of siege. And they have an interest in retreating the military presence because of which this creates for them. So there are many people who are returning, but what's happening right now is that I don't know what the word is in English, repliegue, the retreat of the movement because of the heavy repression in November has meant a great deal of demobilization for the people in the poor barrios and neighborhoods, you know, the more popular neighborhoods, which were the most mobilized. So many people are in fact, the repression and the military occupation had a good effect, a positive effect for the government in the sense that it created a significant amount of fear, and that fear has translated into a large level of demobilization.
Andres, were you present during this repression in October and November by the paramilitaries?
Yes. The paramilitary activity commenced back in August. And then the conditions were created, an escalation of violence during the night in the barricades where there were shootings and whatnot led to the situation at the end of October where the North American journalist was shot in the chest and killed. That created all the justification the state needed to send in what turned out to be over 5,000 troops in the end, as they came in different tandems. And then November was a month of a very intense confrontation, as the state was especially the capital city was occupied, which led to a big confrontation on November 2nd around the university, the state university, where I work, and where Radio Universidad, the popular radio, the voice of the popular assembly, was being transmitted. And that confrontation was victorious for the popular movement as they managed to force a retreat of over 3,000 troops. And then came the repression of the 25th of November, where the actions of the military were far too strong, far too powerful, and that's where most of the arrests took place. And that was sort of a decisive blow for the movement, you know.
Andres, could you describe what you observed during this repression by the paramilitaries? What was the climate like, the psychological climate, the physical climate like, as you were there in Oaxaca witnessing this repression by the paramilitaries in August, September, October, November of this year?
Well, first of all, as I said, the violence escalated significantly, and there was an enormous tension in the evenings. In fact, the whole phenomenon of the barricades was a reaction, a popular reaction to the paramilitary hostilities at night, you know, the shootings and whatnot. And so people, as a self-defense measure, simply decided that at night they would cordon and blockade all the entrances to their neighborhoods, which in Mexico are called colonias, you know, and they would blockade all the exits and entries, and that therefore avoid these paramilitaries entering and shooting in their neighborhoods. That's why the phenomenon of the barricades was so widespread. It was impossible to make a count, but it was said that in any given night you could have over 1,500 barricades in the entire city. As the people became more, the resistance became stronger, so did the violence, the paramilitary violence at night. That led finally to the shooting of not just in North America. Several people were shot in the confrontation of those days. But in fact, the self-defense measures that the popular movement had to undertake became necessarily more belligerent, you know. In fact, as some of the media has shown on television, people now know that there were armed confrontations, you know, on both sides. And this was unfortunately a necessity for many people who decided that they could not simply stand there and allow themselves to be fired upon without responding, you know.
This past December 22nd, a little more than 6 days ago, was a call out was made for international actions of solidarity with the uprising in Awaka. And one of the main demands was for the reappearance of the disappeared. Can you talk a little bit about the disappeared? How many are referred to as disappeared in this repression that we've seen in the last several months in Awaka?
We're talking about a figure of approximately 30 disappeared, but that tends to fluctuate because the way that the popular movement is working, it is if somebody has been arrested, but we don't know that they have been arrested, they are disappeared until they appear, you know. So there are many disappearances which undoubtedly will clear themselves up as homicides or deaths once the bodies are found. And there are others which are simply people who have been imprisoned but haven't been accounted for. So we know that a figure of approximately 30 people have been disappeared. And we know that there have been bodies have appeared in the Atoyac River and other rivers and on the outskirts of Oaxaca. Some of those bodies have yet to be identified. Aside from that, we know that there were initially about on the 25th, the big repression of the 25th of November, 141 prisoners were taken. Many of them weren't even people involved in the movement. They just happened to be in the street when the conflict erupted, and the military police pretty much took whoever crossed the path. Many women, including who were just on their way home from work or on their way to the markets or wherever. On the day subsequent to the 25th, when the persecution became much more selective, they went for the heads of the different collectives and organizations that made the popular assembly. There were approximately over 200 arrests in 72 hours, which was an enormous amount of arrests, 90 of which were teachers. And when the government had said that if the teachers returned to their class, remember that this began initially as a teacher's strike, if the teachers returned to class, their security would be guaranteed, they would not be arrested. And many of them were arrested or attempted to be arrested while giving class or leaving the school, as they would patrol a public school and wait for the teacher to either arrive or leave, and that's where they would grab. That created a very, very tense atmosphere. They created a lot of fear, and that's when people started to leave the area en masse. Some people even went as far as to leave the country.
Andres, you've referred to the teacher strike, and the immediate pretext for the uprising was the police attack in June on a teacher's encampment, which killed or disappeared several people. Now that's the immediate pretext for what's been called the AWAK uprising in the last several months. But clearly there are much more deep-seated reasons for this uprising. I'm wondering if you could speak to those reasons beyond the immediacy of the teacher strike of this year and the coming to power of Ulysses Ortiz as the governor of AWAK back in December of 2004.
Yes. Well, I'll answer that in two parts. One, give a very superficial description of how this movement evolved. So as it does every year there was a teacher strike, and every year there is what we call a plantón, which is sort of the teacher's movement seizes the downtown and sets up camp and camps out and is a measure to pressure the government in the collective bargaining. After the repression of June 14th, this was a government who the Ulises Ruiz, was simply said no to every demand, and the teachers became more belligerent, and then finally he decided to repress. The repression failed as the teachers took back the city center, and many citizens who were never involved in the movement, including citizens who had been historically opposed to the teachers' strike for all the inconvenience it had caused them, came out in support of the movement and to repudiate the repression. From that moment on, we knew that something had happened qualitatively. The teacher strike had become a broader social movement with a lot of citizen participation that led to marches of up to 650,000 people, this in a city of 1 million people. You can imagine how much it is to have 650,000 people marching in the street. After the repression in August, when the paramilitary phenomenon started to rise up, and we saw the citizens creating barricades and a higher degree of mobilization, we could see that qualitatively this first teacher strike, then social movement, had taken on the characteristics of a popular rebellion, you know, and that's what carried it through until November, until the militarization of the city and the state. Now that's sort of the sequence of how this movement grew and how it evolved, and there are many things that one could say politically about the political content of the movement, which had also changed over these last 6 months or so. But the underlying or structural causes behind it were, one, that southern Mexico is the poorest of Mexico, and Oaxaca, along with Chiapas and Guerrero, are among the poorest states of Mexico. Oaxaca, for example, has exports workers to the tune of approximately 150,000 a year. 150,000 peasants and indigenous people migrate out of Oaxaca, mostly to the United States, for the lack of work or any condition of survival there. And the poverty is very evident. And Oaxaca is a state that has been historically dominated by the ruling party, the PRI, the Partido Revolucionario Institucional. And it was dominated by a form of local mafia type of political bosses called caciquismo. That had typically used repression as a form of controlling all sorts of peasant or indigenous uprisings. The governor of Ulises, a man known as being profoundly corrupt and terribly repressive, was a catalyst that sparked something that was already burning under the surface. And the whole thing, his clumsiness, his stupidity, and his avarice, created a movement. You know, people. Some people say, "Well, let's thank Ulises Ruiz for creating something that needed to be created anyway." And the truth is the conditions of Oaxaca are not exclusive to that part of the country. Mexico is heading that way. Oaxaca was a sign of the year that is going to live that country. 2007 and 2008 will be two years of intense political, social, and popular confrontation. We know that violence is going to escalate, that repression is going to escalate, that political disappearances are going to escalate, but we know that the conditions, objective and subjective conditions, are existent today in Mexico for a series of popular uprisings that, if all goes well, will succeed in destituting this president.
Andres, you've described the events in Oaxaca in the past several months of 2006 as the Oaxaca Commune. And I'm wondering if you can explain to our listeners why you use that particular description, which obviously has all kinds of historical resonances. Why do you describe the last several months in Oaxaca as the Oaxaca Commune?
The name of the Oaxaca Commune has been certainly polemic from an Orthodox Marxist perspective. One compares it to the Paris Commune, which was a proletarian uprising, a popular workers' government, etc., and a confrontation with capitalist exploitation. Now, the Oaxaca Commune did not have the downfall of the capitalist system as its strategic objective, let's say. Although certain sectors did see it that way, commune was very heterogeneous, which is the nature of social and popular movements in Latin America. There's not a lot of uniformity. But what gave it the characteristic of the commune, one, was the sense that you got from going downtown and seeing it literally ruled by the people, seeing the city ruled by the people and taken, and brief experiments of self-governance, as the police no longer functioned, insecurity rose, and then all of a sudden certain sectors of the popular assembly began vigilance committees to try to deal with the increasing crime rate, and neighborhood committees were set up to create vigilance against crime, etc. At the same time, over 30 rural municipalities were taken, the most corrupt, for example, the people destituted the mayor, which in Mexico is called the presidente municipal, the municipal president, and set up what they called ayuntamiento popular, popular municipalities. Now, the intent for self-governance was fraught with contradictions and errors and mistakes, which is normal for a society that has been dominated in such a hierarchical way for so many years. But those experiments of self-governance, those experiments of self-organization, the sensation of people learning to self-mobilize, gaining popular confidence in themselves as collective bodies, gave the impression of the commune. It was many people, many diverse people, trying to come to agreements, trying to govern, and trying to make strategic decisions, trying to decide how they will negotiate with the state, etc. Those are the characteristics that led many people to say that this experiment was somewhat like a commune. Of course, from a more orthodox Marxist perspective, that category is simply discarded because it does not fit in with the historical reference that is the Paris Commune.
One way that the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, known as APO, has been described is as a consensus-based network of upwards of 200 groups that are coordinating the resistance within their communities. And I'm wondering if you could describe how the APO functions. That's a description that I've just given, but how does it actually, or how has it worked in practice? Is it a model of horizontal-based organizing?
I would answer that it is and it isn't. It is intended to, but hasn't always worked that way. It's self-governance and horizontal democracy is not an easy lesson to learn. And there are many vices that have been entrenched in almost the centuries of the way politics are done in Mexico that had impregnated much of the Mexican left, whether it was Mexican leftist political parties or movimientos de masas, mass movements, etc. And so many of the organizations which conformed the APO were impregnated by those vices, let's say. And so there was always an ebb and flow. On the one hand, there were certain groups who wanted to establish sort of a cupular structure, a directive coordinating bodies of sort of the most prominent organizations. And on the other hand, there were sort of the grassroots who insistently resisted that sort of manipulation. So there were movements where, for example, there were moments where, for example, the APO had a negotiating committee or commission of 24 people, 28 people that would go to the capital city and negotiate with the federal government. They would establish agreements. They would return to Oaxaca, and in the popular assembly, all those agreements would be thrown into the garbage, simply because they said the people would rebel on a systematic way over months and months and months. They simply rebelled against any form of co-optation of the APO. So, as I said, the APO is and was a contradictory process. It was and was not a popular assembly. Sometimes it seemed much more like a front of organizations than a popular assembly. And sometimes it takes the characteristic of a popular assembly with models of direct democracy, et cetera, et cetera. But what we rescue as we look back upon these last few months of very intense confrontation at nights in the barricades and the persecution and whatnot, we understand that what is left is a great deal of learning for people. Lessons that the people will never forget. They rediscovered themselves as political subjects, as people who don't simply stand by and watch history pass, but people who have the ability to unite and create history for themselves. They discovered that they have an enormous amount of collective self-confidence, that they have the ability to self-organize, to mobilize, to confront tyrants, and they have the legitimate right to depose tyrants when the situation calls for it. We know that struggles like these are cyclical. We know that that they don't maintain these levels of intensity forever. There is always a peak and there is always a sort of retreat, an ebb and flow. But what at least for those of us who are more aligned with La Otra Campaña of the Zapatista Liberation Army right now, or members of that movement, what we see is that there is a great deal of prime material there for the times that are to come, you know, which is a very intense process of accumulating social and political force for the radical transformation of Mexico. And in Oaxaca, the people have advanced over these 6 months a great deal. And we know that the next time they try to build a popular assembly, they will take on a great deal of lessons that they would otherwise not learned had this not all happened, you know? And the rest of Mexico looks to Oaxaca for the next step to see how this will evolve.